Last night, the PBS television series Frontline aired the documentary Syria Behind the Lines. The documentary took viewers to the rural heartland of Syria's countryside, where the bloody uprising against President Assad and his friend has it. The documentary shows how friends and neighbors in the Orontes River Valley are taking up arms against each other. This after, for generations, many religions in the area lived together peacefully, but the attacks from both sides is escalating hatred and violence. Joining us now to discuss the Frontline documentary and the Syrian conflict is Tim Shorn, Associate Professor of Political Science and Director of the International Studies Program at the University of South Dakota. Tim, welcome back to Dakota Midday.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
What insight did you get from last night's documentary, Syria Behind the Lines?
I think one of the things that the documentary did a great job of portraying is that when you look at war, and especially civil war, it's about human beings. It's individual humans who suffer, who pay the price for war. It is also individuals who take sides in particular conflicts like the Syrian civil war, that we cannot, despite all of our discussions about kind of the high politics of the Syrian civil war with the outside involvement of great powers, when you scrape all of that away, it's about people and the effect on humanity.
Is this something that you think usually gets lost in coverage of the war, that human aspect, that the, because as you watch this, you saw people dying, you saw people hurt, you saw crying, it was difficult to watch.
It was, and I think oftentimes we do lose sight of that, of the suffering at the ground level, that we see presidents and prime ministers and foreign ministers and generals talking about this particular goal or that particular goal, a desired outcome, what the international community should do. What we lose sight of then are especially the cost that civilians pay, the price that civilians pay in such a conflict, that we forget that people have their lives destroyed, their economic well-being, that they end up being maimed or killed in many cases, that we have people displaced. And I think one of the things that the documentary did a good job of was showing how it affected the people in the villages when you would have a building, a house that was reduced to rubble with people living in it and then dying in it. And so I think the documentary brought that aspect home so that we understand this isn't about just political issues. This is about the suffering and the price paid by individuals.
Well, let's step back from this documentary, which focused on one area of the country. Mm-hmm. What is the status? What is the situation right now with the conflict in Syria?
It's been interesting to watch some of the reports coming out over the last month where the United Nations and various other international organizations have started to come to terms with the humanitarian catastrophe that this particular conflict is, that we have seen in the month of March thousands of people killed. We're probably looking at a death toll over the last 2 years of 75,000 to 80,000 people. We see almost 1.5 million Syrians out of an original pre-war population of 23 million. So 1.5 million being forced out of the country into refugee camps or homes in Turkey and Lebanon and Jordan. We have another 4 million Syrians displaced within Syria. And so that's the humanitarian cost, and that's what we're seeing certainly within that realm of the conflict. When we look at the larger political issue, we're starting to see a number of countries, especially the French and now possibly the British and others, encouraging the lifting of a European Union arms embargo in order to support the rebels. We know that while on the face of it, the United States is not in favor yet of lifting the arms embargo, but there are also reports that we have actually been training some of the opposition militia members in Jordan or elsewhere. So, you know, we see that at the ground level, the humanitarian catastrophe is much greater than what we thought it was even 2 or 3 months ago. At the larger political level, we're seeing more of the international community attempting to play a role. Certainly, we're seeing weapons and arms coming in from Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries. So I think that this is becoming much bigger than we expected it to be a couple of years ago.
What's interesting in talking about that support from other countries, that one of the fighters in the documentary said that they're waiting for Assad to kill us all and for us to wear out his arms, tanks, and aircrafts. Is that the perspective of the people in the Free Syrian Army?
I think it probably is, that the fighting has been going on for well over a year and a half, since about the summer of summer of 2012, when it really escalated into civil war status, that you've had the United Nations and the European Union talking a lot about it, but not necessarily getting actively involved. And I think that there is certainly a concern amongst the great powers when we look at the U.S. and China, Russia, the United Kingdom, France, Germany, and others, that we're not quite sure how we want this to turn out. The great power cohort wants Assad to stay in power. There are others who are a little concerned about Assad, but they're also concerned about what the outcome would be if Assad fails or falls. So I think that the larger countries, the more powerful countries, have been a little hesitant to back one side explicitly and openly and tangibly to the extent that they did in Libya or elsewhere. It's still a developing situation, while at the same time we're watching that rising humanitarian cost.
What is it that after 2 years, how strong is Assad's government and the army? Are they able to still withstand the Free Syrian
army? They are. They continue to get support from Iran, probably from Russia, perhaps from one or two other countries. So they are still they're still getting their supplies. They're still getting arms. They're still getting money. And I think that they can hold out for quite a while. I think that what we're seeing is very possibly almost like a repeat of World War I without the trenches. We're just going to see a prolonged conflict where neither side is able to achieve an overwhelming military victory, but neither side is prepared to collapse just yet. And so we could see this go on for another year or two or more, and then perhaps just surprisingly end. So I don't expect anything to change in how this war is being fought and carried out in the foreseeable future.
You're listening to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and we're discussing the Syrian conflict with USD political science professor Tim Shorn. In particular, we're talking after last night's documentary, Syria Behind the Lines, which really took viewers behind the scenes to the rural heartland of Syria's countryside, where friends and neighbors that used to live together are now up in arms and fighting each other. In discussing the Free Syrian Army, how united is this, or are we talking a number of different factions with different ideologies and religious beliefs?
We do have disparate forces on the side of the opposition. You have at least what a number of Arab countries and European countries and the U.S. believe to be the sole legitimate voice for the Syrian people, and that is the I always have to remind myself of what it's called, the Syrian National Council. Syrian National Coalition. And more countries are recognizing it as the voice of the people. And France has even gone so far as to recognize it as the future interim government. So you have that kind of civilian side of it. But you also have military forces that operate independently of any civilian oversight. You have the Free Syrian Army, which is made up primarily of deserters from the Syrian army. You also have then the al-Nusra Front, which is an Islamist organization, which earlier this week, at least theoretically, united with al-Qaeda in Iraq. And so you have an increasing Islamist presence with foreign fighters arriving from Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Europe. The European governments are watching Europeans gravitate toward the conflict and take part in it. And the longer that the conflict goes on, my concern is the more powerful the al-Nusra Front becomes, and the increased likelihood that the opposition is going to be taken over by outside Islamist forces that are of the ilk of al-Qaeda. And that means then that the Free Syrian Army might be increasingly sidelined. Or one of my real fears is that we're going to see kind of a second-tier civil war within the opposition forces, the more secular members of the Free Syrian Army versus the Islamists of the al-Nusra Front and their al-Qaeda colleagues. And we already started to see that play out a little bit over the last few months in some Syrian villages.
Now, the regime itself and Assad, the minority Alawites?
Correct. And that is, they make up about 14% of the population. And it is an offshoot of the Shia community. It was recognized more or less as Shia to a great extent for political reasons. It gave them an ally. It also gave the Shia government of Iran, kind of collaborators and colleagues in Syria. So the religious ties between the Alawites and the Shias aren't necessarily recognized by all, but politically it was a good fit. You also have a Christian community that is about 10% of Syria, and they're very concerned about what happens if the Sunni majority takes control of Syria and if that Sunni majority is controlled by Islamists like the al-Nusra Front or al-Qaeda. So you have some important minority communities there, as well as the Kurds, who make up about 10% of the population. The Sunnis are the largest part, and they have not always been treated the best by the Assad family, kind of the Assad dynasty, since the Assads took over in 1970. But the Alawites want to hang on to power, and it's it's fairly understandable. They're afraid to become a non-governing minority, and so Assad and his Alawite friends are going to do the best they can to stay in power.
And in the documentary last night, one of the members of Assad's army said, if they win, they're going to kill us all.
Mm-hmm. And there's a real concern about the possibility of kind of an ethnic cleansing or a genocide. I'd like to think that those concerns are overstated, but one never knows. Once the emotions and the fears are ratcheted especially high in the context of a civil war, what happens in the closing days of a civil war? The international community needs to be very aware of what can go horribly awry in the closing days of a civil war or when you are attempting to disarm populations, and the notion of a majority population oppressing a minority population is a real concern, again, which is why the Alawites and Christians are hanging on so fiercely.
Well, before we go, this documentary is what they're portraying was the different people that used to be neighbors now aren't anymore. Now they're fighting against each other. How assuming this war will end eventually, this conflict will end, how many generations will it take for that friendship and those neighbors to be able to live together as neighbors again, these people that are now fighting each other?
And that's an important question. And as I was watching the documentary, I was thinking back to the collapse of Yugoslavia in the early 1990s, where you had neighbors who had lived in diverse and pluralist neighborhoods all of a sudden turning on each other. And it will take generations before you get a sense of trust or security. And none of this is going to disappear anytime soon. The resentments, the hatred, the fear, the security concerns will remain for decades, if not longer.
Well, Tim Shorn, thanks so much for joining us on Dakota Midday.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Tim Shorn is Associate Professor of Political Science and Director of the International Studies Program at the University of South Dakota. And if you missed last night's Frontline documentary, Syria Behind the Lines, you can view it online at pbs.org.